From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, 1 year after terrorists targeted the city's marathon, Boston comes together to pay tribute to those killed and injured in the attack.
This is an important day. An important day for the survivors, but I think you Bostonians don't understand. It's an important day for the nation.
Also today, federal prosecutors say they can pursue hate crime charges against Kansas shooting suspect. We're in Africa, where dozens of schoolgirls have been abducted by Islamist extremists. And the UK marks the 25th anniversary of the worst stadium disaster in the nation's history.
Over 25 years, you have overcome so many wrongs. For 25 years, you've gained the respect of those within and beyond football and the city.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Tensions in eastern Ukraine continue to rise as the country's government says an anti-terrorism operation against pro-Russian separatists in the area is underway. Ukrainian airborne troops have reportedly landed near the eastern town of Kramatorsk as part of a special operation against the protesters. And earlier, Ukrainian forces regained control of an airfield near the town with reports of injuries. In the hours before the operation, U.S. President Barack Obama called Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss the situation in eastern Ukraine. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
The White House says the phone call was Moscow's idea. U.S. President Barack Obama urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to exert all of his influence to pull back and remove support for pro-Russian irregular forces operating in Ukraine. The American president underscored how much restraint Ukraine has demonstrated and that it is up to Russia to reduce tensions by withdrawing its military from the border. With rising concerns about intimidation and escalatory rhetoric, Washington remains committed to the upcoming talks in Geneva, sending U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. While at the same time, President Obama is warning President Putin, Russia's political and economic isolation will increase if they don't change their tune.
The U.S. city of Boston is marking the anniversary of last year's marathon bombing, which killed 3 people and injured more than 260 others. Wreaths have been laid at the site of the explosions, followed by a commemoration with speeches from dignitaries and survivors. The 118th Boston Marathon is set to take place next Monday and is expected to have the second highest number of attendees in the marathon's history. Vice President Joe Biden said this is a testament to the strength of Boston.
You will send a resounding message around the world, not just to the rest of the world, but to the terrorists, that we will never yield. We will never cower. America will never, ever, ever stand down. We are Boston. We are America. We respond. We endure. We overcome. And we own the finish line.
In Nigeria, about 100 schoolgirls are reported to have been abducted. Gunmen, who are thought to be part of the Islamist militant group Boko Haram, attacked a school in the state of Borno and forced the girls onto buses. The attack came shortly after 70 people were killed in bomb explosions on Monday in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Privacy campaigners have raised concerns over the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation's plans to build a new facial recognition system, which they say could contain over 52 million photos by next year. The Electronic Frontier Foundation says the system will look through a huge database of images to identify someone, based on his or her appearance, regardless of criminal history. Lorna Shattuck has more.
The FBI says its new system, part of the Next Generation Identification Program, or NGI, will reduce terrorism and criminal activity and offer state-of-the-art biometric identification services. But the civil liberties group, the EFF, says this database could hold information on up to a third of all Americans, adding facial data to the FBI's already large collection of fingerprints, retina scans, and palm prints. They're concerned that pictures of non-criminals would be stored alongside those of criminals. That's because under the new system, if a candidate is asked to submit a photo for a government job or a background check, that would now be stored by the FBI on the new database. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
A former counter-terror chief has been appointed in the UK to investigate allegations of a plot by hardline Islamists to take over schools. Officials in Birmingham are looking into claims of a coordinated effort to force schools into adopting more Islamic cultures. UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Peter Clark, former national head of counter-terrorism at London's Met Police, will lead the inquiry into 25 Birmingham schools. Birmingham City Council says it's had over 200 reports in its investigation so far. It follows a so-called Operation Trojan Horse letter uncovered in March, purportedly outlining attempts to install governors and senior staff in schools who would be more sympathetic to Muslim doctrines. But Peter Clark's appointment by the Education Secretary is controversial, with a West Midlands police chief calling it desperately unfortunate because he says unwarranted conclusions will be drawn as a result of Mr. Clark's former counter-terror role. Ollie Barrett, London.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The city of Boston has remembered the victims of the marathon bombings that took place 1 year ago today. Three people died and more than 260 others were injured in what was the worst terrorist incident on US soil since 9/11. Suspect Jukar Tsarnaev is due to stand trial in November, but in a series of events, the city focused not so much on the tragedy, but on the hope that has sprung up in its wake. Nick Harper reports from Boston.
A year on and a city falls silent. At 2:49 p.m., the exact time the two homemade bombs went off, Boston stopped to mark the moment that changed the city. The day began with the families of the three people who died laying wreaths at the marathon finish line. While Vice President Joe Biden led the tributes at the main memorial event.
This is an important day for the survivors, but I think you Bostonians don't understand. It's an important day for the nation. No memorial, no words, no acts can fully provide the solace that your hearts and soul still yearn to acquire.
U.S. President Barack Obama had issued a statement in which he spoke of the city's perseverance, its resilience, and its incredible courage. And that courage is perhaps best represented in the decision of many of the survivors to return to the city. John Odom is one of them.
I didn't think I was going to make it when I was laying on the streets there in Boston. I do not recall anything that happened for the first 3.5 weeks. It's a miracle that I'm here.
He spent weeks in recovery and rehabilitation. For a long time, it wasn't clear if he'd walk again and had to have 11 operations on his legs and many hours of painful therapy. But he is walking once again, using a stick that he hopes he'll soon be able to leave behind. He jokes about hoping to improve his golf swing and says he feels his return to Boston will act as an opportunity for closure.
We all dwell on what happened, but I would rather look forward of where we're going, what we learned from all this, so we're not continuing to talk and dwell on the things that happened to all of us, but where can we go forward?
And it's that message that a year on the city seems to be aiming for, to remember, but also to move forward. Bostonians say they don't want to be defined by last year's events.
We're going to go on. I think we can't let things like that stop us from living.
I mean, I think everyone's just ready for it, ready to kind of turn the page on last year.
We feel like things are back to normal, the locals, at least I do. We feel like things are getting better. You know, we're back to where we used to be again.
I think it's really nice that everyone wants to run again and everything is going as normal. I'm sure the security is going to be way more intense than last year.
And indeed it will. The city's posting 3,500 security officers along the race route. Double the number of last year. Boston University's Dean of Students, Kenneth Elmore, will be at the finish line, but he has concerns.
I am emboldened by the notion that so many people are probably like me, and I'm not alone in being anxious about this. Security measures are going to be tough because there's a spontaneity to the marathon. There's seeing your friend across the street and running over and giving him a hug. I hope that a number of the security measures don't clamp down on that too much.
But the bombing hasn't put people off. In fact, 9,000 more runners are taking part in next Monday's marathon, and twice the number of spectators, 1 million in total, are expected to watch. Not just the city, but the country, it seems, is and will be turning out to show its support. Nick Harper, Boston.
This is FSN Reports. Federal prosecutors say they have enough evidence to pursue hate crime charges against 73-year-old suspect Fraser Glenn Cross over the killing of three people and wounding of several others at two different Jewish centres in Overland Park, Kansas. Cross, who also used the name Miller, was active in the Ku Klux Klan and the White Patriot Party and served 3 years in federal prison for possessing a handgun, conducting paramilitary training and harassing civil rights groups. Our Washington correspondent Alice Olstein spoke to Karen Aresti from Anti-Defamation League about what Miller could face under US hate crime law, considering the shooting rampage targeted Jewish people but took the lives of non-Jews.
The issue really is intent. So why did the perpetrator choose the victim? And it doesn't matter if the perpetrator chooses the victim for a reason that's protected under law, for instance, race, religion, national origin, sexual orientation or identity. The shooter could be wrong in this case, and in fact does appear to be wrong, and it doesn't matter because if he believed he was shooting at folks because they were Jewish, then essentially the motivation for the criminal act is going to fall within hate crime coverage.
And how could that determine what sort of sentence the alleged shooter would get?
Hate crime statutes are called enhancement statutes. And what a judge will do is take into consideration at sentencing whether or not the hate crime aspect has been satisfied, and if it has, then the penalty can be increased.
Does bringing that enhancement charge mean the difference between life and death or many years difference in a prison sentence?
It could. I think it really varies from state to state. And I think these things tend to be very fact-specific. And when you look at somebody like Fraser Miller, you're talking about a professional hater who has essentially created a trail of 3+ decades of vehemently anti-Semitic behavior.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Mr. Miller's record in regards to extremist groups and hate groups? And the FBI said they were not monitoring him despite his long record, and what you think about that?
Miller, I think, had been more, over the past few years, sort of more ideologically active, posting online and trying to distribute these newspapers and running for his failed Senate campaign. He wasn't actually doing anything illegal. So to the extent that federal agents, you know, weren't looking, but there were those of us who kind of were watching him, I think. I mean, can I say that I'm surprised that he did what he did? Given his history, no. It's very, very hard in the case of white supremacy. Particularly some of the folks who are what we call lone wolves, who really kind of do operate on their own, to know for certain when they're going to make a move that could result in the kind of horrific violence that happened on Sunday. And that's the other debate in this country, which is the First Amendment is something we value enormously, but when it comes to this kind of hate speech, do we draw the line? I think at ADL we tend to take a more conservative view that we'd like to see hate speech limited in some way, because I think the real fear is that it can incite people to commit violence.
As this legal case moves forward, what do you want people to learn from it or keep in mind?
People need to understand that the Jewish community suffers this as consistently as any other targeted community does in this country, that we kind of are always in a position to be looking over our shoulder and taking a very conservative approach to community security. And that's a shame that we still have to do that. Beyond that, one of the things that's come out of this is, and this is not just in the greater Kansas City area, but all over the country, really impressive expressions of interfaith support and community building. And that's what always happens with these kinds of traumas, hate-based or bias-based traumas to communities. they end up bringing people closer together because folks learn often about the targeted community and they want to reach out. People want to feel safe, and building community and creating those opportunities for more acceptance and respect are really positive ways to take a community into the future.
FSN's Alice Alstein speaking with Karen Oresti. Now, as many as 100 girls may have been abducted following an assault on a school in Nigeria, according to local police. Officials say the gunmen, thought to be Boko Haram extremists, reportedly attacked the school in the country's northeast, forcing the students onto waiting vehicles. The mass kidnapping comes in the same week the Islamist group was linked to deadly bombings in the capital, Abuja. I discuss this latest wave of violence with our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso.
Well, it looks like there was an incident in which a group of armed men crossed the border from Niger in the northern, the northeastern part of Nigeria, near in the northern state of Borno, which is one of the three states in Nigeria that is currently under a state of emergency, crossed the border and kidnapped over a period of a few hours a range of young girls. In that northern area, and of course it connects with the basic departure point and doctrine of the Boko Haram terrorist group that young girls particularly should not receive Western education, and obviously that forms part of a broader plan to bring complete Sharia law to particularly Borno State in the north, which has been under this pressure and relentless attacks from Boko Haram wanting no Western education in the northern parts of Nigeria.
Gary, have there been similar abductions on this sort of scale? And do we have any idea what these suspected Islamists will do with the captives?
Absolutely no idea yet. And there hasn't been any abductions as such. There's been a lot of killings and a lot of attacks on educational institutions. You'll remember a few weeks back and just last week, there were these attacks on educational colleges where young kids and young students are, you know, frequenting and studying to further their own education. And this is exactly what Boko Haram actually means, no Western education, in a dialect, in a Hausa dialect in that part of the world. So a very, very extreme form of Sharia law that these groups are trying to enforce in that part. No telling what they will be doing with the young girls that have been abducted. There's no immediate concern to think that there would be any life-threatening threats against these young girls, but obviously one doesn't know. The former Boko Haram attacks in those areas on educational institutions have all been very brutal, and the killing has been absolutely incredible, and the levels of brutality in the killings, point-blank range shooting of people in the street by wild terrorists, if one can call them that, coming out on motorbikes and shooting people at random. So a very, very concerning issue for particularly the authorities in Nigeria in those three northern states.
It's an alarming death toll. I've seen a figure of some 1,500 civilians alone this year in that restive region of Nigeria. For people listening to this, Gary, and this story, people must be asking themselves, what's the security situation like? Why aren't these education facilities, these hostels, these schools prepared or better prepared for these attacks?
Now, you have to understand the very rural environment in which these attacks take place. The city of Maiduguri, up in the north of northeast of Nigeria, the capital of the state of Borno, where these abductions took place, in that area, very, very rural. And the security forces are having their hands full in trying to contain or even patrol those areas. I, for once, for myself, have eyewitness accounts of planes leaving Air Force bases in that area, packed with ammunition and returning with nothing left. So there's obviously a very big offensive going on to try and push back these Islamic extremist forces in that area, but it doesn't seem that it's making any major inroads. And it is a major concern for a country about 10 months away in Nigeria from its next general elections, and the issue between the north and the south, the north in Nigeria being primarily Muslim and the south being primarily Christian. Many people thinking that some local politicians are playing into this and trying to make as if the current government and current security forces don't have a handle on this, so it's in their interest to perhaps try and make it look like the security forces cannot handle it. But at any given stage, there are major patrols, roadblocks. You can't go anywhere in those three states without being in a roadblock in within 20 minutes anywhere.
FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso. This is FSN Reports.
93 soccer fans, mostly teenagers and children, have been crushed to death at today's FA Cup semi-final match between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest, held at Hillsborough in Sheffield. Hundreds of people tried desperately to escape the overcrowding by scrambling over fences onto the pitch. Many died crushed against the barriers.
UK news coverage on April 15th, 1989, a day that saw the worst sporting stadium-related disaster in British history. Events have been held today in the UK to mark the 25th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster in which 96 football fans died. The city of Liverpool fell silent at 6 minutes past three local time today, the moment Liverpool Football Club's FA Cup semi-final in Sheffield was halted after a crush that killed dozens of supporters. The 25th anniversary comes as fresh inquests are carried out into their deaths, as UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Graham John Wright.
The names of the 96 being read out at a memorial service at Anfield, Liverpool's home ground. Among the speakers, Roberto Martinez, manager of Liverpool's fierce local rivals Everton, given a series of standing ovations.
Over 25 years, you have overcome so many wrongs. For 25 years, you've gained the respect of those within and beyond football and the city. I know I don't have to tell you, Everton are with you. You know that.
Liverpool coach Brendan Rodgers followed him, the man who has led this world-famous club back to the top of the English Premier League table at a poignant time.
Occasions like this remind the country and the world of how important it is to remember and honour the people that we lost. Both for us, Liverpool Football Club and the city of Liverpool, we carry the memory every day, the 96 people, their families, the survivors. You matter to us every day, and that inspires us to play.
Hillsborough is Britain's worst ever sporting disaster, and for years the families of the victims campaigned for a proper investigation into their deaths and into claims police and emergency services had not acted properly on the day. 5 years ago, then Culture and Sport Minister Andy Burnham was booed at Anfield, with his government ruling out a fresh inquiry into Hillsborough. He reacted by setting one up, and on the 25th anniversary he was welcomed back.
That day your voices were carried off this COP and into every living room in the land, and from there into the heart of the establishment. I knew you were right and they were wrong.
Early claims by some authorities blamed Liverpool fans for the crush, suggesting some had rushed into the stands. The independent panel established by Andy Burnham concluded no Liverpool fans were responsible for the deaths and that attempts were made by authorities to conceal what happened. Trevor Hicks is president of the Hillsborough Families Support Group. He lost his two teenage daughters at Hillsborough and campaigned for a new inquiry.
There will be a great deal of heartache ahead for all of us. But we will get there, just as we've been here for 25 years. Families, we mourn our loved ones constantly, and especially today. But the spirit of the 96 burns in our hearts and drives us on.
Hillsborough did change football in England. Top grounds are all now seated, not standing. Fresh inquests are being held into the deaths of the 96 as well, ordered after the original accidental death inquest verdicts were quashed in 2012 following the independent report. Ollie Barrett, London.
Now, with just under 2 months before the first game kicks off in the 2014 FIFA Soccer World Cup, it's all go as Brazilians scramble to get their stadiums, transport, accommodation and security ready for the biggest sporting event in the nation's history. Over the past 6 months, however, accommodation prices have risen to astronomical levels, especially in Rio, where some hotel rooms have increased by as much as 700%. Some are calling it blatant exploitation, while others simply see it as making the most of a financial opportunity. FSN's correspondent in Brazil, George Powell, has the story.
A ocupação do Morro do Alemão começou na manhã deste domingo.
More than 1,000 police, backed by armored vehicles and helicopters, moved into a sprawling...
I've come to the Complexo do Alemão in Rio's non-touristy northern zone to meet Massimo Giovanni, who'll be renting a room in his house during the World Cup. This housing option certainly isn't for the faint-hearted, as although the favela was pacified by Brazilian police in 2010, the favela still has a reputation for gun crime and violence. Massimo has already hosted people at his home during events like Carnival, and I wanted to get an idea of what he thought it was people enjoyed about staying in a favela. They come here with an idea in their heads of what a favela is like and of the risks involved, but once they arrive, they see it's nothing like that. They see it's actually nice here. They get to experience our culture and see our daily struggle. They tell us about their lives and we tell them about ours. We learn a lot. On days when they don't want to go out, they stay here and we have lunch together, and they always enjoy my wife's cooking. A night in one of Massimo's rooms during the World Cup will set you back 140 reais. That's around $60, a fraction of what a hotel might cost you. But with the threat of potential gun violence, just how safe is it for a tourist? To find out, I met up with Ellen, who's lived in the Complexo do Alemão for several years now and runs a centre for arts and research, as well as a cultural hostel called Baracco 55. I asked her if their guests had ever had any problems.
No, actually, we never had bad experiences. Most of the people even say they feel safer in a favela than elsewhere, because once you enter the favela, people will help you. There are no robberies because it's used to be prohibited by the gangs. So that rule is still respected. You can walk around with your camera and they won't steal it from you.
Another option for the football fan on a budget who's keen for some adventure but not quite ready for the full-on favela experience and isn't keen on the idea of sleeping in a tent is to stay at a hostel in Vigigal, Rio's safest and most luxurious favela. Bernard Hardman is the manager of a brand new hostel that opened in Vigigal last September called Mulata Hostel, and I wanted to hear from him how Vigigal differs from a more traditional favela.
When the dealers, they went out, do you feel more secure, you know, without people walking with guns and motorcycles, you know? So it's much more safe nowadays, much more clean. We are having more different restaurants, one of them with AC, you know. We have like a Japanese restaurant nowadays in the favela, you know. I don't know any other favela that has a Japanese restaurant.
Coming to a World Cup should be about more than just the football. And if expensive hotel prices means that you'll be opting for one of the more non-traditional housing options, then your stay here will probably be all the more memorable for it. George Powell for Feature Story News in Rio.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us reports@featurestory.com, or you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Tuesday, the United Kingdom prepares to bring its first ever prosecution for female genital mutilation. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.